That's so rude.
You love it and you know it.
No?
Hello, hello, hello. I am Pedro.
And I am Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot, even though I have a robot co-host. And this week, we are still in the middle of our twin features, which is actually a triplet feature for the first time that we're doing.
Yeah.
This is Leviathan, Deep Star 6, and The Abyss. Go kiss my ass, Lords of the Fallen. You don't get in here. So
yeah, we don't need it.
Yeah, there are another couple movies made within this time span that were in there as well. But they didn't get a theatrical release, so we're only going to cover those, even though I did watch a little bit of Roger Corman's Lords of the Fallen. And it's not that bad. It's very Abyss-esque, weirdly enough. Hmm. It's about peaceful aliens coming and wanting to let us know not to destroy our planet, because that would be bad. Which it is.
Right?
Thank you.
Good message. Good
words. Roger Corman knew. James Cameron knew. So, spoiler, guys. We usually like to rank all two of the twin movies and say, like, which one of these was better? This would be all three. Clearly, it's going to be James Cameron's masterpiece. The Abyss is going to be the best movie here. That's not really up for debate.
No.
But I think what is interesting is the race for second. And today we're doing Deep Star 6. I had a lot of nostalgia for Leviathan, and I was really surprised how much I didn't like going back to revisit Leviathan.
Yeah.
I very much did not have a good time. I was bored, and I thought the monster was very underwhelming, especially because it was Stan Winston.
Yeah.
I didn't think it moved that well. I didn't think it looked very good either.
I feel like Deep Star 6 is a great 45 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty solid way to put it.
It's really, really boring up front when you're trying to get to know all the characters and what they do and where you're at and all that bullshit. But it's really boring, all of it.
Yeah, I think some of the character work is nicely done. I mean, it's clunky. I think the acting in this movie is solid for a B movie. Yeah. I think it really is. I think this cast does a particularly amazing job with this material. This script is, what's the term I'm looking for? Stupid.
Yes, very.
Stupid. But this movie has, and first of all, I want to give my award for the most valuable player in this film to Miguel Ferreira, because he has to play the film's most unlikable character, and he does such a great job.
He does.
He is so good. Because
I hate him as a character.
But that's the thing. Like, he's not evil. He's just a fuck up.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him really interesting. And I like that this movie has an interesting character in it. And because I can't say that about Leviathan. I mean, I liked Ernie Hudson. He had a couple good quips, but I don't think I could tell you anything about him.
Yeah.
A little bit about Peter Weller's character, but he's the fucking lead. So I should be able to say a few things about him. I thought the character work here was better, even if the script wasn't better than Leviathan's. That's the one thing I sort of wanted to mention offhand. Miguel Ferrer, I think, does an excellent job. We have Greg Evigan, and he's our bearded lead.
McBride?
Yeah, and I think he does a really nice job, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
He does a pretty good job pulling off the 80s, you know, action hero kind of, because this is kind of a, well, I mean, I know there's a monster in this, and it's directed by Sean S. Cunningham, the director of Friday the 13th. But this is like a disaster film, really, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the monster is really a secondary antagonist to just the horrors of being under the ocean. And with that being said, it does feel a little bit more like an adventure. It feels a lot closer to a movie we covered earlier, Poseidon Adventure, than it does to like Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
Even that there is a few touches of that, which is some of that Sean Cunningham's direction. The others is Harry Manfredini's music. I love Harry Manfredini, close personal friend, Harry Manfredini. And I do know, I worked with Harry Manfredini. So yeah, we golf together every weekend. No, but his work here is pretty good. I mean, I do like his score, especially on movies like this one. I think his music fits this better than it fits slasher movies to some extent. His movies, the slasher music, slasher movies feels weird the further the slasher movies go on, right?
Yeah.
Like in the early 80s, you're like, yeah, this is a vibe. And then you're like in the late 80s, and you're like, this feels strange.
Well, you put on Wishmaster earlier and he was in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Harry Manfredini.
Oh, I didn't know he did the music for that.
Yeah.
I didn't know he did. You know what? He has a very unique style.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like his style, but like I said, it didn't age well and then came back around to, I think, people really appreciating it now. A very similar thing happened to John Carpenter, but a lot more appreciation came his way.
Oh, yeah.
I think
he's able to tour.
In the late 90s, nothing was less cool than a synthesizer soundtrack, and John Carpenter had nothing. Nothing! And then all of a sudden, by like the middos, people were like, listen to the Thing soundtrack, or people, not the Thing soundtrack example, he didn't write that, Escape from New York. And we're like, wow, this is kind of amazing, just as music. And it really just grew as this thing. And that's super cool that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing that he's not only a great filmmaker, but his music is also appreciated as well. Something he only really started to do out of necessity.
Yeah.
It's the only reason that we couldn't find anybody to do music. So he's like, I'll figure it out. I got a synth. How bad could it be? But anyway, back to where I was at. Greg Evigan, he plays the lead in this movie. And he had a face that I recognized. And I couldn't place it. So I began to go deep into the memory banks. And when I say that, I Googled him. And I found that there were two things that I was aware of that he was involved in. One of this is probably the crappiest clip I could find on YouTube.
On BJ and the Bear, a new episode at a new time.
BJ and the Bear.
I want that back.
Da-da,
so he
da-da.
Goes undercover as a hijacker.
Did you ever see BJ and the Bear?
No.
Did you just think that was a random thing that I said?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, BJ. Yeah, no. Yeah, BJ and the Bear.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, BJ and the Bear is a show where BJ is a truck driver who helps people, solves crimes, and that's our lead. And he has a monkey with him, a chimpanzee named Bear. He does not work with a bear.
I thought it would be a bear.
No, you would think it'd be a bear.
It'd be cooler if it was a bear.
Yeah, it'd be better if it was a bear he had named Chimpanzee.
No.
That's stupid too?
Yeah.
Okay, see, they're both stupid is the point.
Yeah.
The idea is if it's BJ and the Bear, it should have been a bear or at least a big hairy gay guy.
Yeah.
I could appreciate that. Maybe not 70s TV. I think that was late 70s TV or early 80s. I'm not really certain, but my dad liked that. So I saw that show in reruns a bit. And that's why I was familiar with the other one. I think this show wasn't very successful, but it aired a lot on USA probably because it was cheap and there was probably like two seasons of it. And this is this great area where our hero, Greg Evigan, is tumbling back down from the heights of BJ and the Bear and Deep Star 6. And he appears on My Two Dads, where he goes against the rocket ship that is Paul Reiser's career as the other dad. This is the first thing Paul Reiser ever appears in.
Oh, wow.
This is me, Nicole Bradford. Cute, huh? This is my dad, and this is my dad. How'd I get two dads? They inherited me.
They just tell you what the show's about.
Here's the judge who brought us together. She lives in our building.
My building. I own it.
She's going to make sure we're one big happy family.
That's how sitcoms work, guys.
Down to earth, and
yeah.
With his
head. In case she didn't realize.
The judge who made the wacky decision, she's your landlord, too. And yeah, so this is a young Paul Reiser and Greg Evigan. I think this show lasts two seasons. I saw every episode of it, and I have no memory of it. But the second, like, I heard this theme song when I ripped it, the nostalgia, like, Carlton dance started happening inside my head as I heard this song. So that's why I'm playing it now, and we're listening to every single note of it. But I want to say, that's where I had connections with the cast from the other things they'd been in, and the only other actor that was really a thing for. So the only other guy in the cast that really did that for me was Matt McCoy. And Matt McCoy, he would later go on to do two things of note is, or he might've already done one of them. He would replace Steve Guttenberg in the Police Academy movies. So they just found some other random actor to fill in. I think he did two or three of them after he left. So they still had some success with them, but they weren't really that big a thing. And I think the last two went straight to video.
Huh.
He was the lead of them. And I think he did a pretty decent job. Yeah, Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach, and Police Academy 6, City Under Siege. And then he had a notable guest appearance in Seinfeld as Lloyd Braun. And you never watched Seinfeld, so I was going to play a clip, so it could be kind of painful for you. So I'm not going to do it, and you guys can sort of Google Lloyd Braun. There's a lot of stuff out there. If anybody's a Seinfeld fan, they immediately like, oh, they smiled and kind of chuckled themselves at that. He's one of the funnier characters and one of those guys who got on George Costanza. That was supposed to be Larry David. His bad side all the time. It's a great episode where he is a telemarketer. George is working for his dad, and he brings in Lloyd Braun as another telemarketer, and he's amazing. He makes sales every day. And at the end of the episode, it's revealed that he was just dinging the bell. He wasn't actually making sales, even though he drove George insane. And it's a legendary character and stuff like that.
Fascinating.
Yeah, like I said, it's really the only way that I know any other thing. It's the only way I contribute before we get into your facts about the film.
Very well.
Because that's all I have.
Good.
It's all I have besides talking about Sean S. Cunningham.
Do we really want to go there?
No. I mean, we'll talk about Sean a little bit, but I think he does a nice job for the most part. With the budget, I think he does a real nice job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
He's improved as a director from Friday the 13th. Big time. I mean, this movie still has like long sequences of nothing. Well, we'll get into it. What facts do you have for me?
Can you guess who the stunt coordinator for this film was?
It wasn't Wu Ping?
No.
It wasn't Wu Ping. Wasn't the guy to the Matrix? Okay. Makes sense.
He was in Friday the 13th.
Was it Kane Hodder?
Yeah.
It was Kane Hodder?
Yeah.
Oh, no shit.
He was the stunt coordinator for this entire film.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
The stunts aren't bad in this.
Mm-mm.
The stunts aren't bad. Did he do a stunt in the movie?
Not that I'm aware of.
But say he'd be enormous compared to anybody in this cast. Yeah. Everybody in this cast is
tiny.
He just
plays the monster.
I'd buy that.
Writer Lewis Abernathy sold his script at the same time that friend James Cameron was working on his own underwater monster saga. Despite Cameron's asking that he delay this movie to avoid competing with The Abyss, Abernathy went ahead and was thereby deemed persona non grata with Cameron and associates. Until they patched together their friendship when Abernathy accompanied Cameron on the September 1995 filming of The Wreck of the Titanic for Titanic 1997.
Yeah, I did read a little bit about this, how this really soured their friendship.
Yeah.
Just a personal favor, and I guess he risked a friendship with James Cameron over the film Deep Star 6. That wasn't a good career move, but it lets you know he really believed in this property.
Yeah, that sucks, though. You know.
That's how the film business
is. If your friend's James Cameron, what are you going to do? Are you going to try to go up against him?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, people take that personally, so he's got to know that that's a thing, so.
Yeah.
You know, he's lucky that Cameron is not a guy who holds big-time grudges.
Clearly not.
But, you know, so.
They're still friends.
Yeah, some guys do, so. Maybe he knew that about James and was like, well, it's not that big a deal, and I might have a chance to get a big hit. And that's not really how this turned out, so. This was a, I think they broke even at best.
The film was released by TriStar Pictures in the U.S. on January 13th, 1989. It opened on 1,117 screens and debuted in 8th place with a weekend total of $3,306,320. Its final box office total was $8,153,225.
What was the final total?
$8,143,000.
So just a little bit under their budget.
Yeah.
Which is like 8.4. But yeah, like you said, not a big hit.
Yeah.
Critics did not care for this. They were insistent to be the first to theaters out of all the aquatic films. And they were the first, all right. So they got out there first and they just were murdered in the reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody came to see it. And like I said, the film was a pretty big failure.
Released in January.
Yeah. Well, they were trying, I think, to hit the other. I mean, they were even trying to hit even earlier than that. But they hit that January date, so. I mean,
did The Abyss come out?
The Abyss comes out, I think, in the summer of that year.
Summer.
And I think Leviathan came out. You know, I didn't check when Leviathan came out compared to... We talked about everything about Leviathan, but we didn't talk about the release date.
Yeah.
But we noted that it bombed. It did not do well that week at the box office.
And that's all I have, folks.
So in case you're curious about how the film ended up in that kind of state for an opening weekend, this is a quick hit of the trailer.
Below the surface of the sea, far, far below, in impenetrable darkness, at unimaginable pressure, no form of life we know could possibly exist. Here, there is only silence, and the crew of Deep Star 6.
6 months at the bottom of the ocean. It's more than I bargained for.
They are explorers.
Let's bring it aboard and get the hell out of here.
What's the matter? You gonna let a few ugly fish scare you?
They are invaders.
Okay, boys and girls, don't try this at home.
In a world which no human being...
I will say, this movie does look like it's almost from a different era than Leviathan, right?
Take a look. Yeah, it's like a 70s movie.
Yeah, Leviathan certainly looks like a movie from the late 80s when you watch it. The Abyss looks like a movie from the 90s because of the CG.
Yeah.
And so I just one of the things I kind of wanted to mention is I felt like this very much felt like an early 80s movie or a 70s flick. I don't know if that's because of the Manfredini music or just the look of the cinematography, which I don't think the cinematography in this is bad or anything like that. I do want to mention that we began watching this movie.
Underwater scenes are just atrocious.
Yeah, they're not very good.
You can't see anything.
Here's the thing I wanted to mention is we started watching this on, I think, Pluto, right?
Yeah.
And the Pluto copy was not very good.
No.
It was not very good at all. Very dark and murky. And then we turned it off one day because I think we just ran out of time to watch a movie that day. And the next day, Pluto had lost the license for it. So we had to rent the movie, and we just rented the YouTube version because it was the cheapest one available. And it was clearly a brand new 4K or 1080 transfer.
Yeah,
and it looked great. It was night and day.
Yeah.
The movie looked quite sharp, incredibly sharp.
But the underwater scenes still looked bad.
Yeah, they did. The underwater scenes, a little bit of clarity helped there, but I still thought that they weren't very good. However, I is it weird to say I expected worse?
I don't know what I expected, but I wasn't pleased with the results.
Yeah, I know a lot of people like Leviathan's work, but like the second we started watching that copy on HBO Max, I was like, that's dry for wet. You know, I could, you know, when I watched it as a kid, I knew it wasn't, they weren't in water. I could just tell.
That's okay.
It's not a big deal in Leviathan. It's not at all a big deal in Leviathan. Here, like you said, it does, the effects don't really hold up so well. And the stuff they do shoot underwater, you can tell they really did it because it also looks bad because they were trying to shoot as quickly as they could.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, there's some stuff obviously later where you can tell they're in a tank and like they're just, you know, that's what underwater shooting is like. It's hard. You know, mm-hmm. It's very difficult. Film cameras were big and unwieldy even then, you know, and taking them underwater was no easy task at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, I mean, now, you know, with digital cameras, it's harder. But, you know, there's things you can do around. There's a lot smaller cameras you can use.
Mm.
Yeah. Crazy. So it doesn't help with a movie like this. Before we start really getting into the movie, what's your numerical rating on Deep Star 6?
I gave it a 5.
You give it a 5?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm at a 5 as well. I think I ended up just liking this a little bit more than I like Leviathan because I think this is a B movie and it very much knows it's a B movie. It doesn't really attempt to be really anything else but that. And at the end of the day, as a B movie knockoff blockbuster or mockbuster, if you will, I think it's a pretty well executed one.
Yeah.
It's fairly well shot. The score is engaging. The effects aren't that bad. And I think the monster's fairly well designed. It doesn't move all that well, but it is a pretty good, it's a better design than what Stan Winston came up with. So, I mean, 5 is kind of rough because it as much as I like some of the character work, man, it really bogs down at like 40 minutes.
Like I said initially, it's a good 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. If this was a TV show, it would be an awesome episode, sci-fi episode.
Yeah, great kick-ass episode of The X-Files.
Yeah, great, great episode.
Yeah.
But as a movie, I just don't think it holds up. So I give it a 5 because I appreciated the acting and I appreciated the action at the last part of the movie. So that's...
Yeah, because really once the monster shows up or once the monster takes out the sub, things really do pick up in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
things really, really pick up in the movie about the hour mark. And then they hold pretty steady. Once again, this isn't exactly like Aliens, but it still is a pretty solid film, I think.
Yeah.
For a B movie.
It's no Abyss.
No, it's not that.
No.
So let's go and start breaking it down.
All right. So just like Leviathan, we have shots of the ocean. We go underwater. There's a bunch of fish.
As there should be.
And then there's the title cards.
We get Deep Star 6.
We see a shark.
I think I'm sad this wasn't a hit, so we couldn't get Deep Star 69 as like a parody.
And this is where I first note that it looks like there's Vaseline on the underwater sequences.
Yeah. All right, let me try to make a different title joke. How come we didn't get to watch Deep Star 5, 4, 3, or 2, or 1, huh?
Yeah, I don't understand the title of this film.
I think they just picked something that sounded cool.
I would have liked that trivia. Like, what the fuck? Deep Star 6?
I think it was probably just like a word salad kind of thing. They just threw things together and went, hey, that sounds kind of ominous, doesn't it? And they just ran with it.
It sounds like, I don't even know. It just doesn't sound appropriate.
Well, I think Leviathan's a very good title too, even though if there isn't a giant aquatic sea creature in it.
Mm-mm.
So that's kind of disappointing. And The Abyss is also a very good title.
Yeah, I was so disappointed when it turned out to be a ship in Leviathan.
Yeah, it's just the name of the ship. Wow. It's not. Yeah, you thought it was going to be a giant sea monster.
Yeah.
As you were. Well, you know, it just makes sense. Yeah, that's how it goes. Anyway, this one's, I think this title is fine. Lords of the Deep, that one's not so bad. The Rift was the other movie. That's also not a bad title, so.
All right. A couple wakes up and talks about their relationship.
So, yeah, we immediately start getting, it's like some really rough exposition to start this thing.
Mm-hmm.
We meet, I talked about him earlier, Brian Evigan, and Greg Evigan, pardon me, and his fantastic beard. He plays McBride, and Nancy Everhart is his, right?
His love interest.
Yeah. Collins?
Collins, yeah.
Yeah, so they do have a little bit of chemistry. It's not like there isn't anything there, but I mean, it's not like, you know, heating off the screen or anything like that. But they do play off each other fairly nicely. This scene isn't awful, but it is a lot of exposition. It's a bit like everything in the movie is kind of a cliche, but I feel it's executed with a little bit more earnestness than George P. Cosmato's effort last week.
Some of the crew hop into a little sub and they go for a drive.
Yeah, pretty much it. We get our lead here, McBride, and this is the first time I believe we're introduced to Hodges, right?
Yeah, there's Hodges. There we have the captain.
Yeah, we have the captain, and that's, you know, the captain is like a pure stock cliche character.
Yeah.
Right? He's like the older individual. He can't wait to get back and spend time with his family. Because I think the first time we sit down with him, doesn't he show like, this is my son, he drew that. What an artist. Like, well, you just signed your death warrant, sir.
There's Snyder, who is the sniveling character.
That's Miguel Ferreira.
Yeah.
The guy from RoboCop. We covered him already. He's also in a great movie called The Night Flyer. Check it out.
There's Scarapelli.
Scarapelli, yeah. That's the other woman on board.
Yeah.
That's that's Hodges' girlfriend.
Yeah.
They have that shower scene together later.
That girl has some fans. Some of the reviews I read were all about her. Oh, because she has the workout
scene.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she has the leering workout scene. We're totally getting way ahead of ourselves.
Sorry.
Hey, you're the one to start this.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is on you. You were excited about Deep Star 6. Look at you.
All right, so they've been this whole situation for 6 months. They call Snyder for a shift change. They land and the crew disembarks. One of the team members argues on what the orders are, and Snyder and crew have to have breakfast together.
Now, it sounds like we're skipping over a lot, really, but it's just there's a lot of like dialogue back and forth about the situation.
Nothing much is happening.
You know, occasionally there'll be nice, spicy bits where one of the guys like, I'm tired of reading the same article in magazines over and over again.
Yeah.
And listen, like that's okay. That's better than just saying like, boy, I can't wait to get back to shore. So I mean, it's at least a little bit better than an awful script. I think one of the big saving graces of Deep Star 6 was my low expectations.
Collins talks to Snyder and the crew about a cavern she thinks she found.
So, yeah, we sort of get this concept just kind of thrown out there. They're like, hey, like, there's a cavern there. Could be dangerous. Might not be. Who knows?
So, yeah, so they do a lot of talking about this cavern and what they're supposed to be doing. One of them suggests that they blow it up and continue as planned with what they were going to do down there.
Yeah, the head of the operation.
He's like, we got a quota.
He's like, we've got to keep on moving. Just blow that thing up.
Yep.
She's like, we don't know what could be down there. Like, I've got to take a look at it.
Snyder goes back to breakfast and he tells them Collins and crew found a cavern and Scarapelli is really interested. She goes to her boss because she wants to examine the cavern, but he is having none of it.
Yeah, he doesn't really give a crap about any of these issues about it. He just wants to blow through this and move on.
Yeah. Then we have a scene where we have Doc Norris, and she fixes up Snyder because he's been injured.
Then Snyder, I like this scene here because Snyder's already begging to get off the ship, right? Or to get off
Oh my God, he's complaining.
He's sniveling already, but it lets you know that he's cracking. And I do like that it's sort of set up here because he's going to do some bad things later on. And we already know that even before all this stress comes into play, he's not in a great space.
Yeah.
He's not in a great headspace at all.
No.
So I love them introducing that here.
Yeah, it's a slow burn.
Yeah, it really is. Slow.
Very slow.
Yeah, very slow. Very slow.
So Norris promises to get Snyder topside because he keeps complaining that he's tired of being.
Yeah, he's like, don't worry. You will get out of here.
Captain, he talks to Scarapelli and she tells him she wants him to help convince Van Gelder to let her examine the cavern. And he's like, okay, because she really goes in for the fight. She's like, I really want to examine this cavern. There could be stuff in there that we don't know. There could be other marine life that we're not aware of.
Yeah, you just don't want to shoot a rocket in something and we don't know if there's some plankton down there that can cure cancer.
Yeah,
exactly. Why don't we take a look and see what's in there real quick? And it's a pretty reasonable request, but like I said, they have a few days left and he's got to try to make as much money as he can.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you make a note about her workout sequence?
I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know. We'll see if it comes up. Because it's the most pervy this movie gets. And there's a shower scene that's not even that pervy.
No.
Yeah. Well, it comes up after the shower, before the shower scene.
Yeah. We just got to that point. I was just about to read what my notes were.
So I was dead on about when this occurred in the film.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of rare. We watched this movie a few days ago. Very rarely do we wait this long, but it just worked out timing-wise because July 4th.
Yeah. Happy July 4th.
Happy July 4th, everybody.
So Scarapelli angrily works out.
Yeah, and this is, like I said, Sean S. Cunningham kind of leers on her a little bit, but I don't think he's particularly egregious about it.
No, it's just ridiculous, yeah. though. She takes a shower. She makes out with Richardson.
I like this because she runs out of hot water because she's hit her allotment. And then he comes in and he just puts his key card in there. And she just brings him in fully clothed and they just start making out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little cheesy, but I do like this little bit of character here. This part of it doesn't bother me. This is fine. And there's no nudity in this scene, guys.
No.
So don't bother checking for it. You don't see Nia Peebles naked in this.
There's some more horrible CFX, but they end up collapsing the cavern. Snyder basically goes for it when they really haven't told him to do it. He just does it anyways. And he ends up shooting off like this big shockwave from the explosion.
Oh, wow. We're already going to that?
Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk about the submarine at all that they had out there?
Yeah, there was horrible CFX, so I...
Oh, is that what that is? Okay, I didn't know that was...
there was horrible.
Okay, so before I have a few things I want to say. So we have this really long sequence in there where they're, I guess, exploring the cavern is what they're doing with the submarine. And Sean Cunningham chooses to shoot this as one shot, basically, of two guys sitting inside an obviously phony mini-sub.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much it. They cut from into there, they cut to the bridge, and then back to the sub again. We rarely see anything in the water during this whole thing. And it's about, like, what? A pure, like, 7-minute scene.
Yeah.
Takes quite a while for them to go down there, lay their charges and everything like that, and take a look inside. They send a drone, and it does give a little bit of nice underwater footage. That's probably the best underwater footage they maybe get in the movie. But I'm assuming they probably just bought a real drone footage for that right there. Yeah. I just wanted to mention, like, it's just one of the movie's more painful sequences, something Sean Cunningham is not very good at. Like, this scene could have been easily cut down to, like, 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on double the amount of time it needs to really stay on for and really drags the proceedings down. Well, never really adding any tension. I mean, at the end of the day, the drama in the scene comes down to these guys going, it's getting closer. I see it on the sonar. Ah, you know, I mean, that's it. That's really all they're doing. And I know you don't want to show the monster early, but like, you got to give me a little something.
Mm-hmm.
Like the monster is entirely like a POV effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
We only see like what it sees. We don't get it revealed at all until, I mean, we're another 25 minutes away from that event.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole ship is attacked. Man, you really skipped a lot because then...
No, I realized I had said something that I shouldn't have said. I foreshadowed to like...
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. So yeah. I'm recapping a lot here. Okay.
Yeah, no.
I really want to talk about some of these events that come up. And that was one. The submarine sequence is just painful.
They sent out, like you said, they sent out the remote device. They detach and go looking for it. They see some strange marine life. Hodges lies to Colin about losing the remote as nothing happened.
That's the thing. They tried to cover up for their incompetence.
Nothing's happening.
And it's not that big a deal.
Suddenly the music changes and we get a POV of something. They start freaking out and the thing goes towards them. Collins calls Snyder and wants him to go get the captain. We get another POV shot and it's the creature ramming the sea track.
Yeah, and this just comes, like I said, the guy's just with the camera shaking and them trying to sell it. We don't get an on-screen death for these guys, but they do die here.
Yeah. Snyder gets the captain, but Collins isn't there anymore. The captain and another guy head out to look for the sea track. Collins goes to check on her buddy. He's okay for his legs.
Yeah, and so this is also the actor from Spider-Man 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
He plays the landlord. Where's my rent money? Like, you know, that's where people know him. The second people, like, all I had to do was say that and people immediately saw this guy's face if they've seen those Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies.
Yeah.
Rent? Not now. Listen, it's a free country. It's not rent-free country.
Leave me alone.
Give me rent.
You'll get your rent when you fix this damn door!
That wasn't cool.
He is a good boy. He must be in some kind of...
You get your damn rent when you fix the door! You know, like that's the whole sequence that he's from. And he has a brief little bit here. He gets his legs crushed. And you don't really get an effect for his legs crushed. It's just the water's red. I mean, it's fine.
Yeah.
And...
This movie was cheap.
Yeah, this movie was cheap, but doesn't look as cheap as it could have looked.
Yeah. McBride and the captain talk about him marrying Collins. They have a moment together. I like the captain's character. I was sad that he died.
Did she already get the pregnancy test yet? Or is that later?
I think that's later.
That's later. Okay, my bad.
Yeah, we're both like...
Yeah, we got thrown off about where things are in this movie. Yeah.
The thing starts following them, so they kill the lights.
Yeah, I do like this bit, because this is the captain and our hero, the beard, who, by the way, I forgot his daughter's in a dance movie that I like, Step Up 2, Brianna Evigan. She's in that episode of... crap. She's from Dust Till Dawn, the show as well.
Huh.
I don't think you ever saw any of those. Mm. Yeah. Well, she was a star too for like, oh, we'll have to cover her in Sorority Row. Yeah. The House in Sorority Row remake. She's in that. She's the lead.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I liked her back then. She didn't make it.
They escape and continue their search for the sea track. They find it and attach to it. They go in and find the hatch is stuck.
So this is more Sean Cunningham. Like, oh man, how do I increase the tension here? I know. Let me show them slowly lifting the hatch every moment of it. And I was waiting for like you'd see like a few inches come up and he's going to cut back to those guys struggling. And then it was going to be up. All right, I think it's as far as it can go. Nope. We watched them slowly pull the thing all the way up to where a man can get through.
Yep.
I will say it does establish the weight and how difficult that thing is to move. I will say it certainly does do that. Because they go in there and the landlord from Spider-Man, he's already died.
Yeah.
So they just have to slowly get everybody out of there.
They just have to get Collins out.
Yeah, they just have to get Collins out. And they pull Collins out the last second. And right as Collins and McBride get through the door, the captain has the door that we just saw, in painstaking detail how heavy it is, go up, come right down on him. And it's super metal, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't chop him in half. It's almost kind of worse, right?
Yeah.
Because they're like, we can get you out. We can get you out. He's like, it broke my back. Just leave me. And I love that. That's so cool. He's like, just leave me. It's over. And they won't listen. And first of all, the one thing that made me laugh in this whole scene is like, he is clearly stuck under immense weight. And so Collins is just tugging on him like a toy she's trying to pull out from like underneath the couch. Like, oh, yeah. Maybe I could just pull him loose. If you pull him loose, you're going to cut him in half.
Yeah, and then, like, the captain, in order to kill himself, basically floods the compartment.
Yeah, because they probably would have stayed there.
And they still try to fucking save him, when they flood the compartment.
Yeah, he doesn't give them a choice. He hits that to get the hell out, so they leave, and they almost drown trying to save him. But they do eventually leave him there to his fate.
Yeah. Collins and McBride are
it was a metal death.
Devastated by what just happened. They get back to the base. And basically nothing much happens. Richardson goes and talks to McBride and blah, blah, blah. And then we move on to the next scenes.
So, yeah, I mean, that, you sort of really summed it up. Like, there's a big death that occurs here and people just sort of chat amongst. Yeah. Well, there's more little character beats in between people about like what could have been down there. What did it? You know, I think there's a little scene after this, because they have to, everyone has to talk about how they feel about the death, yeah, which is weird. But McBride and Hodges have like a scene, and Hodges says, I know how close you and the captain were. And he hands him a picture, and it's McBride and the captain, like arm in arm, looking at each other lovingly. And I'm like, maybe you went a little too far on the like, hey, make them look like they're good friends. These two guys look like they are just about to start making out.
Yeah.
I remember when I saw that picture, like, whoa, how close are these guys?
So Snyder hops on a computer and reports what Collins went through.
This is...
And then the crew just joke around after like four people died.
Yeah. They're just having chow. And, you know, if they made one reference to, like, gallows humor or something like that,
yeah,
I think I might like this scene. But it feels really weird they're just, like, joking around when the captain just died 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah, I know.
It's different if, you know what I mean, if, like, something legitimately funny comes up. But they're trying to have jokey dialogue. It's not quite the same as, like, having a laugh in a dark situation, mm-hmm, you know?
And this is where I was talking about earlier, where I got myself ahead of schedule there. Snyder launches some missiles. The crew goes to see what's going on, and the ship shakes. And this is where he fires the missile at the cavern.
So, okay. Once again, this is going to be Miguel Ferrer's... Well, not Miguel Ferrer as an idiot, pardon me. Miguel Ferrer is a fantastic actor. Sadly, we talked about him last week. I believe he was a witness to the death of Dominic Dunn, or the assault that killed her. Was a very, very good friend of hers. Sad to bring him up for that reason last week. This week is what I want to talk. A few weeks ago, this is what I want to talk about. For being a really fantastic character actor, Snyder is literally going by the book because the computer asks him, what kind of reason do you have for getting ridding yourself of the missile? So he calls over to sickbay and he's like, hey, would you say what attacked you was aggressive? And she's like, well, yeah, it was aggressive force of some kind. And the doctor's like, fuck off and just fill out the report. So he's like, aggressive, huh? All right, great, aggressive. He picks that option. So the computer's like, oh, there's an aggressive force attacking us. Oh, I guess we should explode the missile so it doesn't fall into Russian hands.
Yeah.
So he literally fucks everything over by being a dumbass.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that it's him being an idiot. I mean, yes, it's stupid in the screenplay, but the character is shown to be a burnt out fool. He wasn't that great at his job to begin with, and he is barely hanging on at this moment. So he does this, sends this giant shockwave and nearly destroys the base and sets them in deep shit.
Oh, yeah. Big, nasty wave. The base starts to crumble from everything. There are leaks everywhere, and the crew is doing their best to mitigate it. So there's this very long sequence of, like, all the crew members running around, getting things and patching things up, and, like, it's just a montage, basically.
Yeah, people are trying to fix things, and some people are getting to the bridge and trying to figure out what's gone wrong. You have Snyder's like, I did it by the book, you know, which, I mean, it's not, I mean, technically he did, but that's, he should have used his brain to just be like, no, we're just leaving the base. I need you to deactivate the missiles.
Their efforts are successful, but they realize that their air supply is affected. They got about 7 to 8 hours left.
Yeah, they just have the standing air in there. And also because they only have the standing air in there, they will not be able to depressurize. So they have no escape option to the surface at this point.
And they also realize that they're sitting on a giant reactor that's about to go super critical.
And they're out of Twizzlers.
God damn it.
Everything's going wrong for them. The nuclear bomb, the nuclear base they are sitting on is about to go thermonuclear. They are absolutely fucked.
Yeah.
So they come up with a plan. Hodges and McBride are really men of action, which I kind of enjoy here. They're going to try to rehook up a system so they can depressurize.
Yeah.
So that sends Hodges out in one of their deep diving suits, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And these aren't as cool looking as the ones in Leviathan. I will say that. But this does lead to, I think, one of the better underwater sequences.
Yeah, they put Richardson into a big bulky suit. I mean, it's really bulky. It's bulkier than Leviathan's suit.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like something from 1930s, but like if the 30s was trying to be futuristic.
It really was. That's why, you know, it's whatever in the art design. It doesn't bother me. Yeah. I don't think it's like shit or anything like that.
It just seems weird.
Yeah. Well, I watched the Roger Corman movie and that had bad dive suits, but this was fine, but I think this sequence works okay.
Well, they drop him in and he clears the airlock. He's walking around in the water, I guess. You can't really see shit, so it's hard to tell what's going on.
And I'm okay with it to some extent. Like, you'd have trouble seeing down there in general. Everything's dark and there's probably a ton of sediment and ocean floor that's just floating around at this moment because of all the from the explosion.
It. Yeah. Don't shoot it.
Don't even make a movie.
Fucking, if you can't make anything seen underwater, when your movie is an underwater flick, then it's really kind of pointless.
It is. They should have made a movie in a plane. Is that worse?
Sure.
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 Sure. Yeah. I don't think it's that bad, but Meredith has a lot of issues with it.
Everything goes fuzzy, and you can hear Richardson start screaming.
Yeah, this is the general cliche of like, there's something out here. You say it? Yeah. And you just hear these little bit like, what are you talking about? I think you should get back to the ship. Like, yeah, no shit.
So that's what Richardson is basically trying to do. He's trying to get back to the ship. So they pull him up and he's freaking out.
Yeah. He's completed.
He's not alone.
Something else in the airlock. He hooked up the hose, but something came back with him.
Yep.
And when they pull him up, this is pretty cool because he's screaming in there. No, 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 no. There's something with me. Something with me. And I love that. That's really cool. And then the monster pops out and it looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
It looks pretty cool. Then he's pulled back down. Hodges goes down. They pull him back up again as water floods in everywhere again. And it's just half of Hodges.
Yeah.
And like he's swinging, Richardson, swinging back and forth as like his guts are coming out. It's very cool. His girlfriend is like screaming hysterically over and over again. That's Scarpelli, right?
Yeah.
All this is actually a really well done little sequence. It's a great bit of chaos. As the monster comes in, the monster doesn't move quite so well, but it does look nice.
The room starts flooding. This is where Scarapilly gets got.
Yeah.
They rush out of the room and lock the door behind them. No thanks to Snyder. Snyder just stands there while everybody's like trying to get in, and they're banging on the door, and they finally, somebody lets him in. Snyder's just standing there. McBride, Collins, and Snyder argue, but come together after Snyder admits he's scared. So this is when they're arguing amongst themselves. And I really thought that they were going to beat the shit out of Snyder.
Yeah, I really did too.
But they end up actually like trying to like calm him down.
Yeah, she really does. She goes over there, she tries to chill him out, and he just breaks down. It's actually a good scene. That's a good scene.
There's a scene where they get these exploding guns and spears. So when you stick something with it, like a bunch of air goes and they explode.
I will allow the exploding spears in the realm of this film because those are aquatic instruments to protect yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see divers and guys who have to work around sharks have those every now and then. I'm okay with that. But why in the blue fuck would they pack shotguns for the underwater voyage?
Is that not the right
weapon? It's the same problem I had. It's the same thing I probably had last week with Leviathan. Like, what the fuck do they need a flamethrower at the bottom of the sea? They didn't really have a reason for it. The shotgun, there was literally no reason for you to have it.
Reason for the season.
It's like Armageddon, the gun in space.
Yeah.
Like, this, it's the same difference. Like, why would you even have that? But I will let it slide in this B movie that they just have shot. Well, I'll let the spears go, but the shotguns I did not. That's a point off.
Yeah, the spears make sense.
The spears are fine, but the shotguns are a little too much.
They put some lights in the water because one of them says, oh, you know, like, aren't sea creatures attracted to light and all this bullshit? Which is true.
Yeah, the monster has been, they've shown it throughout the film, so that works.
If you've ever gone pier fishing, you always want to get a spot under the light because that's where the fish go.
Yeah.
They go about trying to patch up the hole. McBride fixes the hose but gets knocked back. Snyder sticks Van Gelder by accident.
Okay, there's 2 points here I want to get into. One is, this is the same place the monster was hiding in the original scene. This is not a new joint. They walk in and they're like, where is it? And I'm like, yeah, where is the gigantic monster from earlier?
Yeah.
Like, he can only hide in the one spot. The second it moves, it's going to displace enough water. We're like, it's over there. You know, there's no stealth from this monster, is what I'm saying. And the idea that it's just hiding from them is ridiculous. It's not as ridiculous as in the 1998 Godzilla, when they're like, where did it go? We can't find it. Like, guys, it's a giant lizard.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure someone has eyes on it. It's the same thing there. Like, there's zero stealth in this option. But for some reason, he lays perfectly still in the water and they can't find them. And everybody fans out and it does a nice job building some tension. And then the scene kicks right into high gear as that monster pops right out. And like you said, they have those spears that inject all that air into you, and he gets scared and walks right into Snyder's spear.
Yeah.
And his chest inflates, and boom, he just explodes right there. It's very metal. I loved it. I thought that was a great death, a great scene.
And Snyder obviously freaks out because of this, because he thinks everybody's going to kill him or something because he made a mistake.
Yeah, because he killed the boss.
Yeah. So he freaks out so much, they inject him.
Yeah, they have to basically just put him down. They literally puts him in a chokehold and they inject him so he just calms down so he won't hurt himself.
And
this one really wasn't his fault. You know, I mean, no. It wasn't. The guy backed right into him.
And all his teammates are with him. Like, yeah, even a doctor like pulls him aside and starts like comforting him.
Yeah, I mean, he fucked a lot of things up. But I mean, what are you going to do when a giant fucking monster attacks? There ain't no guidebook on what you do. He held his ground and the guy in front of him jumped back right into his spear.
So the doctor confronts or comforts Snyder. She goes off, leaving him alone, and he starts to have hallucinations.
So this is a super Sean Cunningham scene right here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like this feels out of a different kind of movie, but I like this scene a lot where like he comes back with like the hole in his chest, like blood pumping out of it. He's like, look what you did to me. You killed me. Like just right there, like attacking his guilt.
Yeah.
And I think this is fun. I really do.
So he freaks out. He pulls a lever to try to escape and he gets in one of the pods. And he says, fuck it, and hits the button. As the doctor's trying to tell him, like, you're going to kill yourself. You haven't decompressed.
Yeah, she's screaming it over and over again. Yeah. You haven't depressurized. And like, she's going up there and he's shutting the doors and they're about to close like on her. And you see the beard go up there and grab her and bring her down. McBride, where she gets chopped in half. Cause he's like, no, I already saw this in the movie.
Yeah.
And I like that he was the one who's like, no, who knows that situation. And like, he just grabs her and throws her to the ground from like 10 feet up. Right. Mm-hmm. But he's like, well, that's better than being chopped in half. I've already seen that once a day. I wasn't going to watch it again. So I like that character beat.
Yeah. He pulls a lever and tries to escape. As he gets in the pod, he starts to slowly explode. So his nose bleeds.
Shooting blood, a little bit of blood here and there. Yeah, then it just becomes everywhere more and more. Yeah. And then like all his skin is just covered in blood.
Yeah, he explodes.
It's awesome. It's a very metal. Super, super cool death.
Yeah.
Super cool death.
Meanwhile, they have about 3 hours and 45 minutes left until boom.
Yeah, so they still have that ticking clock, even though it's not really that much of a concern at all. It just gives them an excuse to have to try to get out of the damn water.
This is where McBride and Collins take the time to make out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We forget, we skipped over the pregnancy announcement earlier.
I must have missed it in my notes.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a baby together. And I always laugh because he has a weird reaction when he finds out. And I thought to myself, like, does he have a wife and kids back home on land? I always thought, like, is that really the story here? But we'll never know.
McBride, he chooses to be a hero and he goes underwater. And this is Colin starts to pray.
Yeah. So he just goes out there without a suit, right?
Yeah.
Just goes out there and swims and finds a submarine.
Yeah.
And sure.
Yeah. Right?
He's
a hero.
I think there's a scene in the movie Sphere as well, where Dustin Hoffman is at the bottom of the ocean. He goes out without a suit to swim from like one sphere to another. They're not spheres. There's only one sphere. But you know, my point is the same. He swims into another part of the facility. And I remember thinking, like, that's not possible. But I think he does it in the book, too. So maybe there's something I don't know about swimming underwater without a suit.
Yeah.
But either way, it occurs in this movie. I didn't 100% buy it, but I will allow due to the nature of this film.
McBride makes it to the sub. And the Collins and Doc have a moment while all of this is going on. I wrote down short, choppy sentences because there's really not much going on.
It's just the back and forth. Things are just happening. Yeah, the conversation while he's... There's no cut. They show a little bit of him swimming out in the water, but there's not a whole lot of shots that they really got. So it's not like cross-cutting. It's more just like occasionally they'll remind us that he's out there until he eventually just makes it back with the submarine.
Yeah, Collins hears some tapping on a door, and she thinks it's McBride, so she opens the door, and a bunch of water starts rushing in. Yeah.
Turns out the water was knocking.
Yeah, and then they eventually got the door shut. The monster shows up.
Yeah, the monster returns now that we're in the third act. The monster, really barely an inconvenience. Snyder kills way more people than the monster does.
The doctor turns on some lights to distract it from Collins. Doc grabs some electrical paddles and electrocutes the monster, what we expect would be killing it.
Yeah, but it does not. She electrocutes the crap out of it and then eventually sacrifices herself. But the sacrifice made sense. The monster had her head in its claw.
Yeah.
She was going to die either way. So she shocks all the water as McBride and Collins get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
That was a good death. I like that scene. So
they are now about 8 minutes from meltdown, but they have to decompress enough to detach it and get to the surface.
So Sean Cunningham style, we slowly watch them decompress over 8 hours. No, but the movie just slows down for no real reason here, right? Yeah.
We watch them decompress. They finally decompress.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get out of there. And the station explodes and there's shockwaves.
Yeah, like there's no real drama from the station going to explode. Mm-hmm. Because they slowly decompress and then they get into a sub. And we have one shot as they clunkily rise into the...
Up and up they go.
Rise to the air. And that's it. Like, there's no drama in the ship exploding. They just get to land and they deploy the boat and there's nothing else going on.
They make it to the surface. The creature comes for them.
Of course. It's Sean Cunningham. Just like little baby Jason coming out of the water to grab Alice at the end of the first movie. The Deep Star 6 monster comes up and tries to grab
McBride.
McBride's beautiful beard, but he does not grab it. He's able to hide from him in the ship until he's able to set fire.
Yeah, he starts a fire that explodes the sub to kill the monster.
Yeah.
But McBride makes it.
Somehow. He's not really shown jumping away or anything.
I'm fine with the ending.
Yeah, I'm just like, well, it's a happy ending. I don't really care. He should get away with his...
Yeah.
either his new bride or his very long explanation to his wife about why he shouldn't work 6 months under the sea again. Under the sea! I give it a 5. A little bit more watchable than Leviathan. I ended up enjoying it a bit more. I don't love it, but, you know, oddly enough, I think it's one of Sean Cunningham's better movies.
It's, to me, the 45 minutes is better than the whole of Leviathan.
Yeah, I think so. As much as I like the actors in Leviathan and some of the effects, I think this, as a B-movie, just works a little bit better.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it, so.
Well, let's find out how others felt about this movie.
Yeah, this will be a short part here. We just need to find out how they felt about it. Roger Ebert wouldn't touch this movie with a 10-foot pole.
Really?
Yeah, he did not review it. As far as I can tell,
he reviewed The Abyss?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to. It's a James Cameron
movie. Yeah. This movie is a 15% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got a 5.3 out of 10 on IMDb. And this movie has a bit of a following. I guess because of Sean Cunningham. I don't know.
It's ripe for a cult movie. I mean, it's just a kind of low budget underwater, but it's not that low budget.
10 out of 10, a fine outing for Sean S. Cunningham.
A fine outing.
Here's an odd one from Sean S. Cunningham.
Mm.
The man is no stranger to the exploitation genre, and in many ways, DSS has some of those staples. In case you didn't know, DSS was Deep Star 6.
Oh, is it? Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Because I would not have guessed DSS.
Yeah, he starts it off right away, and it took me a minute to.
Oh, man, we just should have been calling this thing DSS this whole time.
Several moments of extreme violence showcase Cunningham's love of the horror and gore genre. However, DSS is a very different entity in its own right. Cunningham gets to the most of his actors, specifically from a sniveling performance from the extremely talented Miguel Ferreira, who steals every moment of camera time up until his horrific death. DSS makes the most of $8 million it cost to make the film. Cunningham surpasses his own prowess with the showcasing very strong performances, good cinematography, and a great monster. In comparison to the other films in this genre, Leviathan and the Rift, for example, DSS is a more satisfying film.
I haven't seen the Rift all the way through, so I can't testify to that, but more satisfying than Leviathan.
Unfortunately, the film was one big issue, and that lay within its tired and predictable plot. But let's face it, we don't go into Cunningham's film expecting The Abyss or Alien. If that is what we were comparing this to, then one will infinitely be disappointed. There is no philosophical undertones here. We get what we expect. A monster movie underwater with some people doing some stupid things to make the situation all the worse. Point is, take the brain cap off. Enjoy the performances. You already know how this ends, but like a roller coaster, just have some fun with it. I think if audiences and critics alike had approached this movie with the same ideology, DSS might have a stronger cult following. This is easily the very best from Sean Cunningham. Yes, it was clearly made to bank it on the yet-to-be-released The Abyss.
Yeah.
But regardless of the film being made to solely make money, Cunningham seemed to have really tried to make a competent film. And I feel he really succeeded in this effort.
I mean, it's competent.
Yeah.
It's a very competent film. It's a very cromulent film.
The guy made some good points.
The movie doesn't have bad cinematography at all. We certainly noticed that when we got the better transfer. But it's not poorly done. It's just a low-budget, kind of like late-night cable movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's a pretty adequately executed one. And that's not something I could say about Leviathan last week, which is very similar. But I thought that was poorly executed despite good performances and some nice effects.
Yeah.
You know, and then when the effects let it down, that's what put it down to the 4 level for me. Where this movie's effects aren't great, but they don't detract from it, you know?
Yeah.
I can tell from the budget of this movie that I shouldn't be a snob about the effects in it, you know, unless we're going to spend 40 minutes in underwater action sequences, then sure. But that's not what it does. It's smart enough to avoid that. I think this is a decent little creature feature.
Mm-hmm.
Not much more than that, but, you know, if you're looking for, if you like aquatic movies, you know, and you haven't seen Deep Rising yet, watch that.
Yeah.
Watch Deep Rising again. But this is pretty good too. And I think you might enjoy it if you like movies like that, but you're certainly not going to love it.
Yeah, I don't really recommend it. I don't think the 45 minutes is worth it. I think you can find better television somewhere else.
Certainly so. And obviously with the aquatic films of 1989, we will be covering the cream of the crop next week with James Cameron's The Abyss.
Yeah.
This show is about 1 hour, so, or a little bit less than an hour, probably 55 minutes. So look for next week's show to maybe go about 90, because there's a lot to talk about in The Abyss.
Well, we get to finally talk about one of our favorite directors, James Cameron. The
next week's show could easily go quite long. It was tough to always find things to talk about with Deep Star 6, but we did. We enjoyed it, and we hope you enjoyed it too, and we hope you guys come back next week as we finish up Twin Movies, the triplets of Underwater Adventures of 89. We
didn't do our socials.
We didn't. No. Do it now at the end of the show.
All right. So if you think that we suck at doing our social media stuff, then you tell us at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com.
We're hitting the exit music. You can also find us at Gritty Reboot at TikTok and Instagram. No one's listening anymore.
I know.
Good night, guys. We hope you enjoy your July 4th or whatever weekend you might have. Have a good one, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.